The psychedelic revolution is here. If you want to integrate your visionary experiences into your purpose, get clear on your entrepreneurial path, and help people while you do what you love, then this podcast is for you. Welcome to The Psychedelic Entrepreneur, Medicine for These Times. I'm your host, Beth Weinstein. I'm a spiritual business coach, three-time entrepreneur, and a lifelong student of psychedelics and sacred plant medicines. You carry your own unique medicine, and your medicine is what we need for these times. This podcast will help you to share your medicine so you can create transformation in the world. Listen in on conversations with psychedelic leaders, changemakers, and conscious entrepreneurs who are living proof that a better world is possible when you follow your heart and live in alignment with your soul. Welcome back to The Psychedelic Entrepreneur, Medicine for These Times. We have Ife Tayo Harvey today with us. Hi, Ife Tayo. How are you?
Hey, Beth. I'm doing great. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thank you for being here and taking time out of your busy schedule. I really appreciate it, especially with all that you've had going on lately. So Ife Tayo is the founder and board president of the People of Color Psychedelic Collective and is an outspoken advocate and writer in the drug policy reform space. She builds a platform for folks of color to learn about and create community around psychedelics. She's also social media manager at Caring Across Generations. Prior to joining Caring Across Generations, Ife Tayo worked at the Drug Policy Alliance for 5 years because of her passion for ending the war on drugs. She comes from a family of 7 children raised by her mother in Charleston, South Carolina, and has a bachelor's degree from Smith College in History and African Studies. So Ife Tayo, let's hear your story. How did you end up going into drug policy reform and becoming a leader in the space? And then also, you know, the other work that you do now. What was your career? And by the way, I know Smith College very well. Awesome school. Yeah, but how did you end up on this path? What's your history?
Thank you. Yes. So I guess I'll have to rewind a little bit back to my childhood. So when I was 4, my father was arrested and sentenced to 15 years in prison for cocaine trafficking. And he was incarcerated until I was 12 years old. And after he was released, he was deported back to Jamaica. And so this was an experience that really impacted me on a deep level. You know, I carried a lot of shame and depression and just uncomfortableness around what this meant for me as a kid. And it wasn't until I was older, I would say 18 or 19, where I finally really, I guess, opened up to myself about what this experience meant for me and how it impacted me. So I start talking about it my freshman year of college at Smith. And I had some other friends at Smith who had similar experiences. And so that made me realize that I wasn't the only person who went through something like this. But it wasn't until my junior year of college, I was looking to do an internship. And I came across the Drug Policy Alliance's website. And I remember thinking, like, wow, I've never heard of this organization. I've never heard of any organization that does this kind of work. I never saw an organization, much less anyone, talk about people who use drugs or people who are drug involved in a non-stigmatizing, compassionate way. And so for me, when I saw DPA, I was like, I need to apply. I want to intern here. This is a place. And so I did. And I got the internship. And when I started working there, I was just like, you know, it was kind of, I guess it was kind of surreal for me, but I ended up learning so much. And the folks at DPA really encouraged me to write about my experience with my father. And so I wrote an op-ed titled "Children of Incarcerated Parents Bear the Weight of the War on Drugs." And it was really talking about how, you know, when people are sentenced to prison, no one thinks about the children and how their kids are impacted, right? And how the war on drugs has separated and destroyed many families. So from there, I was invited to speak at DPA's International Drug Policy Reform Conference. I was the opening plenary speaker, and I was super nervous about it, but but through that experience, I found healing, you know, being able to share my story with people and have, you know, so many people come up to me and tell me that they related to it and that my story touched them. And at that same conference, I attended a session on end-of-life anxiety and psychedelic therapy. And I was like, oh, I've never heard of this. You know, I've heard of psychedelics, you know, and through my friends in college, or, you know, my mom told me about psychedelics in the 70s, but I had no experiences with them, really. I was mostly a weed and alcohol person in college. And after, you know, sitting on the session, I was kind of thinking to myself, like, wow, I think I should try this, because I'm struggling a lot myself with anxiety and depression. I was, at the time, I was a senior in college, and I just felt so much pressure, right? So much pressure to find a job, so much pressure to, you know, perform well academically, and also so much pressure to just keep it all together. And in some ways, I related to what they were describing about people with terminal illnesses who have a particular anxiety around death. And so I was like, okay, I want to try mushrooms. So I went back to school after the conference, and I started asking my friends, like, okay, like, how do I do mushrooms? How much do I take? Like, what is it like? Like, what do I need to do to prepare? And they're, you know, they're giving me the rundown. And they're like, oh, you should take like 3.5 grams, and you should do it in the morning, and you should like go out in nature and make sure you have a sitter, someone sober. And so I was like, okay, checkbox, you know, checking off everything, preparing. And so it was like one Saturday morning, I decided to do it. And I had one of my best friends there with me. She was a psych major, so I felt very safe with her. And we went, I ate the mushrooms. I actually put them in like a peanut butter sandwich. That's what someone told me to do. And I ate the mushrooms, and we went on a nature walk around the pond at Smith. And I remember walking, and I started feeling it kick in, and I was like, whoa, I kind of got overwhelmed. But anyhow, it ended up being a good trip for me. You know, it opened my eyes in so many ways. For most of my life, I wasn't religious or spiritual in any way. Actually, as a teenager for most of college, I identified as like agnostic or atheist. And then after doing mushrooms, I was like, whoa, like this is showing me things that I only thought I could see in dreams or something. Or like, it reminded me of my childhood imagination. And yeah, so it ended up being a really great experience for me. I think that like, I was reminded of why I'm here, you know, reminded of what is so special about life, why life is worth living. And after that, you know, I ended up finishing at Smith, graduating, and I actually got my friends to do mushrooms like 2 days before graduation. so that was funny. But anyways, after I graduated, I kind of bounced around, you know, like a typical college grad looking for jobs. And I landed a job at MAPS, the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies, as Rick Doblin's assistant. And, you know, I was familiar with MAPS at that point. But being Rick's assistant, you know, it showed me a lot about, you know, all the major players in the psychedelic space, all the research and work being done, the potentials of psychedelic healing, and, you know, just working with Rick is just kind of, it's own thing, you know, he's his own, he's his own person. And so it got me really excited about healing and helping people. That's a passion of mine, just helping people. And being at MAPS, I was really excited by the work they were doing. But ultimately, it wasn't a great fit for me. So I left after being there for 8 months and ended up moving back home to South Carolina, where I'm from originally. And I got a job offer at the Drug Policy Alliance, where I interned. And so I moved to New York in 2016. But I still wanted to do work around psychedelics. And DPA's priorities at the time wasn't in psychedelics. And so I kind of just started organizing with the people that I knew. I wrote a piece for Symposia called Why the Psychedelic Community is So White, kind of, you know, sharing my experiences as like the only Black person at MAPS in 2015. And so I still get people hitting me up from that piece to this day. People saying like, oh, I saw your piece online. I haven't seen a Black person when I Google psychedelics, so you're the first one that came up. So, you know, I honestly, if you told me at Smith that I'd be working in psychedelics, I would probably laugh at you, because that was not my plan or intention at all. When I was at Smith, I wanted to be a high school history teacher. I ended up not getting any teaching jobs, or all the teaching jobs I would try to apply to just didn't work out. And so I got into drug policy reform and psychedelics. And with the People of Color Psychedelic Collective, it's really about educating and community building. Because when I was at MAPS, I didn't really see a lot of conversations that were specific to issues pertaining to Black folks or Indigenous folks. It was more in a general sense. And I recall, you know, one time at MAPS, and we were during our staff retreat, they were going over the demographics of one of the studies, and there were no Black participants hardly. And I was just like, oh man, this is awkward. And I think at that moment, MAPS was beginning to understand that like they had an issue when it comes to race and inclusivity. So that was, I guess, my motivation for starting the POC Psychedelic Collective, was, you know, creating a space, creating dialogues that pertain to our issues. And I think a lot of people kind of take it the wrong way. You know, some folks might think like, oh, you're excluding white people, or like, you don't like white people and stuff like that. But it's really about just, you know, creating a space for us, right? Doesn't mean white folks can't come to our events or, you know, interact with us. It's just an intentional space for people of color. And so I've been, you know, just really lucky to have a great team working with me. And with the pandemic, that shifted a lot of our work styles. Before the pandemic, you know, we would partner with other psychedelic societies and do panels. And then we had our conference in DC in 2019, the Empyrean Conference. But then when the pandemic came, we were just like, oh man, what do we do? So we pivoted online to online webinars. So we've done everything from like general healing with psychedelics to cultural appropriation to death and dying, harm reduction. We even had a virtual art show called Blackadelic Black Atlantic. That was really awesome. And so this year, I'm really excited for some of the things that we're going to be doing. We got awarded our first grant last year and fundraised, I believe, like $45,000. So I'm really excited for, you know, what's to come. Next month, I'm going to be hosting a conversation with my friend, Fabiola Santiago. She is a cultural worker from Oaxaca, And we're going to be talking about the intersections of psilocybin, cannabis, and mezcal. Really talking about her experiences being from Oaxaca, being someone who teaches folks about mezcal, and also someone who has experienced, you know, the traditional mushroom ceremony in Oaxaca.
Wow, this is beautiful. I you had mentioned this mezcal connection, which, you know, I have not heard anybody talk about, but this is really beautiful, and it's offering up these new perspectives. Now, I'm curious. It's interesting. I recently interviewed a friend of mine who has been part of my own medicine community in the New York area. I lived in New York City for 21 years until about 4 years ago, and it's interesting. Like, our community has always been pretty diverse because she's one of the organizers. She's Puerto Rican. Her husband is Jamaican. They brought in their friends and family. And over the years, it's just been, you know, relatively diverse. But there we are. You know, most of us were based in the New York City area. So for me, you know, my ceremonial experiences over the last 10, 12, 15 years, it didn't even occur to me until I actually launched my very first psychedelic summit. And I almost had a heart attack. I was not only just white, but it was actually back then it was majority male. I had a hard time finding women who were outspoken, you know, who were leaders in this space. And I actually remember feeling very crushed at the beginning. Like, wow, why is this all white men? Like, I was just shocked. I didn't know. But I'm so glad you're doing this and having there's so much more movement between, you know, the work you're doing, you know, the Ancestor Project, more and more discussions and talks. I've worked with, you know, Darren LeBaron over in the UK. But I'm curious, you know, what is it that you've seen change, especially since the pandemic, within the people of color community and this growth in psychedelics? So beyond just cannabis, which we all know is always, that was a little more on the forefront. You know, it's been decriminalized and legalized for, you know, for a while in many places. But what's happening when it comes to psychedelics? Like, does it feel like there's actual change being made, or is it just the beginning? Like, what is the feeling out there in the communities that you're leading?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that since the pandemic, I feel like psychedelics, work around psychedelics and interest in psychedelics has increased so much. So much so that I can hardly keep up with all the new groups, all the new interests, all the new people getting involved. I would say that there is there's a hunger for psychedelics, learning about psychedelics, working with psychedelics in communities of color. I think there's also a lot of like interest that's like, okay, I want to learn about it, but I'm still a little cautious, right? I think there's a need for folks to kind of unpack drug war propaganda is what I like to call it, right? Because so many of us have been miseducated about the war on drugs, and it's left a lot of us ignorant about how drugs actually work and impact people. So I think there's a hunger to learn about psychedelics, especially in this time of COVID, where so many of us are struggling with this new way of being, right? This new normal that we're going through. So there's that. I also noticed that there's just a lot of interest from like the for-profit side, the investor side. And so that's also something that I wasn't seeing as much, let's say 5 or 6 years ago. I also noticed like the mainstream narratives, like in the media, are also changing in terms of how we talk about psychedelics. I think that there's this narrative that that says, oh, are psychedelics going to be the next magic bullet, right? Are they going to be the next Prozac, right? And so, and so it's kind of like this integration that we're doing, integrating psychedelics into the mainstream. But to me, I personally think we should slow down a bit, right? And kind of think like, okay, we all know that it is an injustice for someone to be penalized, to be criminalized for using drugs, right? And we all know that psychedelic substances have healing potential, but how do we want to see them used in the future in this country, right? Do we want them to be seen like weed, right? Where there's dispensaries and people are buying them and just using them casually? Or do we want them to be more protected or treat it more sacred, right? And I think that a lot of people don't realize that we have options and we have a choice and we have a voice and we have power in terms of deciding how we want psychedelics to be dealt with on a policy level. They don't have to be, it doesn't have to be a free-for-all, right? Like, we can organize ourselves and say, like, hey, we want our regulation model to look like this. We want our regulation model to look like that. So I think that a lot of people are kind of feeling like, oh, well, you know, the investors, they already got everything. We're already falling behind. There's nothing we can do at this point. Like, and to some extent, I understand, like, where that sentiment comes from. But at the same time, I do think that it's not too late for us to change the way things are unfolding. We can, you know, really make a change and decide how psychedelics should be handled. And in my opinion, I think it's about making it accessible to everyone, right? And not having, you know, corporations have a monopoly over psychedelics, right? I think it's, you know, you can look at cannabis, right, and see that some states implemented home grow and some states didn't, but having the possibility to grow your own cannabis is a beautiful thing because you can do so many things with the plant itself, and it also doesn't force people to have to go outside their homes and buy it from someone else. And like, these are plants, these are fungi, these are things that the earth has already given us. So, you know, they're going to do their own thing regardless. we just have to, I guess, listen.
No, it's interesting. I was going to ask you about accessibility. This has come up pretty much with every interview I've done for the last few years, including the one I just did right before you, which, you know, as this grows so much and then, you know, like, this is, again, this is what I just spoke about in this other interview, was that, yeah, the media is portraying this as like kind of this, you know, like, oh, this will just fix you. Like, this is it. This is all you need. Just take a psychedelic. And they don't talk about all the other work and all the integration and all the actual therapeutic value of working with someone, whether it's a therapist or a coach or some kind of support system or a community or an integration circles. And then what I've witnessed, just being someone who's been working with medicine for a very long time and then working with psychedelics for over 25 years, you know, as it's changed and as it's grown and then now things changing super fast, along with this mental health crisis we're having on such a large scale, even I have gotten, it's just been so apparent that almost desperation for people who don't know where else to turn. And then they hear on the news, oh, well, these, I hear these help. And then I have friends who are psychedelic therapists, like official licensed ones, and they quite literally have no space. They can't take on more clients. And then additionally, it's very expensive. And we all know it's not accessible. Like, even when I found out how much ketamine therapy was, I was like, that doesn't make any, like, to me, it's a lot, you know, and I get it, you know, I understand why, but, you know, and I have friends who are hosting healing, you know, underground healing circles in, you know, communities of color where they don't have the accessibility. And even then it's a struggle to afford maybe, you know, $150 to do combo or whatever it is, you know, or even to get their hands on some mushrooms and have a proper container to do it in. So what is the conversation around accessibility, especially coming from, you know, I don't know if this comes up with the Drug Policy Alliance or different groups that you work with. Like, what do you feel like is the plan to address this? Because everyone I've asked, you know, there's a lot of mixed answers. And right now, I mean, even the person I just interviewed is like, well, it should only be therapists offering this. But then it's like, not everyone can pay $1,000 to go to psychedelic assisted therapy. Mm-hmm. So yeah, what is your view on accessibility and how we're going to solve this issue?
Great question. I think ultimately we're kind of looking at this issue a little bit backwards, right? Because we're like, oh, well, you know, is there a way we could like give free sessions or lower the price and all this stuff? But I guess the point that a lot of these narratives are missing is that the systems that we already have are failing us as it is, right? So, you know, we're going on year three in this pandemic and we still don't have healthcare for everyone. Right. So if we don't have basic health care for everyone, we don't have paid leave for everyone, sick leave, right? Then how are folks supposed to even get these issues are going to continue because they were an issue before psychedelics even came into play. And so I think part of it is like we as folks in the psychedelic space, we may need to coalition build with folks in other spaces, folks who are, you know, advocating for healthcare for all, folks who are advocating for better labor practices. You know, we can see how a lot of service workers are being treated. And I don't think a lot of people connect the dots in terms of like, if the people who get paid the least in our society get paid more and increase their worker protections, and that benefits everyone, right? Including the psychedelic therapists, including the people who need the psychedelic therapy. I think we have to focus on fixing those healthcare problems. It's kind of like driving the car as you're building it. Because this is all unprecedented, right? Like, We've never done this before, and we're trying to not only integrate psychedelics into the mental health care system, but also figure out, okay, how can we make this accessible and affordable to folks? So it's almost reminds me of, I think this is an MLK quote, but like integrating into a burning house, right? So in my opinion, we have to fix these systemic issues as well, because if we don't, then, you know, psychedelic therapy is going to be only for the folks who can afford it, right? Folks who are middle class, upper middle class, wealthy folks. And I think the psychedelic community can take a note from the harm reduction community, right? In terms of, how do we get things done? How do we save lives? How do we heal people? And sometimes that means breaking the law, right? Like, a lot of people don't want to hear that, but it's the reality of it, right? If you look at the history of harm reduction, a lot of these folks who were giving out naloxone, who were giving out sterile syringes, who, you know, were giving out other drug paraphernalia, those things were illegal in a lot of states, and they still are. There's a lot of states that outlaw syringe access. But the harm reduction activists, they persisted anyway and still did it because they knew that it was about saving lives, and that's more important than anything, right? So if we as psychedelic enthusiasts want to say like, hey, like, fuck it, we're going to figure out a way around this bureaucracy, around like all of these rules, you know, while respecting people's safety, I think there's ways to do it. I also think that it's complicated because the medicalization model seems to be the easiest trajectory for us to like get legalization. But I think we have to remember that the medical community has had a hand in upholding the war on drugs. They have harmed people. They have criminalized people, right? Here in New York State, and I'm not sure if this is still the law, but for folks giving birth, you would be drug tested after you gave birth. And if you came up positive for cannabis, you risk having your kids being taken away. So we also have to remember that history. And it's not only policing, it's not only prisons and jails, it's also education, right? If you are a person who, you know, gets caught using drugs, you can lose scholarships, student loans, all those things. And same with the medical community. If you're a parent who uses drugs, if you are even just a patient who admits to using these substances, then that puts you in all kinds of jeopardy. So I think we have to expand beyond thinking like, oh, the medical model, that's it. I think we have to recognize that, like, psychedelics have existed outside the medical model for a long time, and the sky has not fallen. I think that a lot of times when it comes to, like, legalization, decriminalization, people, you know, see the medical model as the most valid because, you know, if you have doctors and nurses and all these degreed people agreeing with you, then it looks legitimate, right? We saw that with medical marijuana, right? It was kind of like getting your foot in the door with medical marijuana first, and then recreational can come next, right? And we don't have to do that. We don't have to validate psychedelics in that way. We can just say that people don't deserve to be criminalized, number one, and then number two, figure out what regulation model we want to use for different substances. I feel like I went all over the place because I do not even remember the question.
No, it's actually great because this is almost the polar opposite of the previous interview I had today where, so it's interesting, you know, and I try to stay very neutral as to, like, I don't know what's right or wrong, but mm-hmm. I'm also very realistic, right? We are in a mental health crisis. I am personally, my former partner is a somatic therapist. So mm-hmm. he was a New York State therapist, but not licensed with the state because he has 6 years of training, but not board certified, licensed, you know, he's in a different system. But it was fascinating to watch the amount of people who would reach out saying, hi, I'm looking for help. Do give out psychedelic therapy? You know, and then people even coming to me asking for it. And let's be real. This has been underground, quote unquote, like for centuries, right? For eons. Uh-huh. This has been, you know, like especially these plant medicines that have been, they're part of ancient indigenous spiritual and healing practices. So there is the reality of this, these have been used long before people wanted to create venture capital funds to uh-huh. bring it to, you know, psychedelic therapy in the medical model, right? Like you were talking about. So I've been asking a lot of my guests, like, what do you think of the fact that there are people out there doing kind of, let's say, underground therapy? We all know this is going on, whether it's in a ceremonial setting or having someone hold the space or even, you know, a friend sitting for you. You know, now people are even selling, like, trip sitting classes. But it is happening, and there's a reason why. It's not just people having fun tripping. There's people that are really like, I don't know where else to turn. So how do we solve this issue of it's going to happen? The demand is high. The supply of psychedelic therapists that are licensed are just, we can't keep up. Mm-hmm. And then there's some people saying, well, only therapists should do this because it's, you know, it's dangerous. And then mm-hmm. we don't know what could happen. And then there's ethics. And then, I mean, we all know there's so many issues, right? But then it's also, I'm one of these people that believes, like, the biggest crisis is the actual mental health crisis. Or like you said, the actual systematical problem mm-hmm. is that the system doesn't serve, right? Like, people can't even get basic health care, much less mm-hmm. Mental health. So I'm curious, like, in the communities that you've been a part of and the drug policy world and, you know, being a leader, what do people think of the fact that there are coaches or healers or underground therapists doing this work that are not officially licensed or that are not being regulated or, mm-hmm. you know, we're not monitoring because it's still illegal or it's only decriminalized, but it is actually still illegal? Yeah, what is the solution, and how do you feel about this? I'm curious, because it's a weird world that we're in right now, right?
Yes, totally. You know, with this, I see both sides of the argument, right? I have several friends who are therapists, and I almost was a therapist myself. I decided not to go that route, but and I also have been in therapy for over 10 years now, and it's been very beneficial for me and super important to my self-care. So I understand the question around ethics and safety. I think that's super important, especially when you're talking about underground work, because people are harmed by, I don't want to say underground therapists, but people do experience harm in the psychedelic space. People do experience abuse and unethical, you know, actions and behaviors, right? So I think that is a huge issue that, you know, some folks are trying to figure out how to tackle. I know there's folks who are organizing themselves into like a professional association, so they can have like a board of people who you can come to if you feel like someone did act in an unethical way towards you, right? I do think things like that are important, and I do think we need to have more discussions around that, because a lot of times what happens is that, okay, someone gets outed or accused of abuse, right, in the psychedelic therapy, and then, you know, there's an uproar about it, and then after a few weeks it just dies down. And, you know, the person who's accused might get, you know, pushed out of their organization or resigned, whatever, but outside of that, there's not really much done, right? There's not, people aren't informed of it, so the person who was accused or who did these actions can kind of like be quiet and then kind of pop up again and start, you know, platforming themselves as an expert, right? And then the people who experience the harm, they may or may not receive help. So I do think that is a big issue, but I don't think that only pertains to underground therapists. I think that it's an issue even among licensed therapists. It's an issue even outside of psychedelic therapy, right? There's a lot, I mean, I don't want to give therapists a bad name, but there are bad therapists out there, right? Just like there's bad doctors, bad teachers, whatever. I do think that a lot of people respect the underground work because, you know, when I was working at MAPS, I was also like you, getting emails from folks being like, I need help. And sometimes I would, you know, want to take the time to talk to these folks because, you know, you can only tell someone like, sorry, we can't help you so much, right? And to me, even though I couldn't give them psychedelic therapy, I thought the least I could do was just talk to them and hear them out and hear their story, right? And there are some people who were really traumatized, like, on a deep level, who had no hope. And this was the thing that gave them hope. So for me, I think that the underground therapists are similar to like the underground harm reduction workers or the underground safe injection sites. I think that, ultimately in terms of solving the problem, I think that we need to make it easier, well, I don't want to say easier, but more accessible and more affordable. We need to make becoming a therapist more accessible and more affordable. We can look at what's happening with COVID now, right? Like, nurses are quitting left and right. Doctors are quitting left and right. Some of them are dying. Therapists are burnt out. They can barely take off time for themselves. So we need more. And for so long, these institutions, the academy, have excluded people, you know, based on the amount of money they make. So many of us have student loan debt. That was the reason why I chose not to become a therapist myself, was I looked at the financial aid package they were giving me, and I was going to graduate with $40,000 in debt. And this is on top of the $25,000 in debt that I already have from undergrad. And I was like, I can't, like, I don't want to do this. And and even after you finish social work school, you're expected to, like, do the supervision hours. So we've made the path for becoming a therapist or doctor, nurse, all these things exclusionary. And if we want to change it, make it more accessible, we need more therapists. We need more people trained. We need and I think we also need to validate folks who don't want to go that route, who have other forms of training. Like you said, you know, a lot of these psychedelic substances come from indigenous knowledge. And I think understanding different indigenous groups' way of training and initiation is really important as well, because a lot of folks aren't comfortable in the therapeutic clinical setting. For a lot of people, that's triggering for them because they've been harmed by doctors, nurses, etc. So we have to also recognize that, like, okay, there's other ways of training and teaching people how to hold space, how to be healers, and that's valid too. But ultimately, I think it's about creating the type of environment where accountability is everywhere, where accountability is built in, where it's not about, oh, I'm going to hold you accountable. It's about, I'm going to hold myself accountable to my values, to my integrity, to my ethics. Instead of like, oh, I have to like call you out or whatever, you know, people feel like they are held to a certain standard. And I guess going away from that standard is something that people just wouldn't want to do. And that's not easy work. You know, I said all this, this is not work that happens overnight. This is not work that happens even within a year. This is work that takes a lot of time, and we have to be patient. That's why I said earlier, we have to slow down and really think about what we're doing, how we're moving. And I hope that COVID has shown us that we move really fast, in life. And I think about how I used to be before COVID, and I'm like, how did I do all that? Why did I do all that? You know? So I think that it requires us to be patient and patient with ourselves, patient with other people, and really be open to learning, to being challenged, and owning our mistakes when we make them.
Now, this is so beautifully said. It's funny because I was originally on the path. I went to undergraduate as a psychology major and a minor in art history, and I had this dream of becoming an art therapist until I realized how much schooling I would need after that. And I was like, there's no way. And it is interesting. You know, I get a lot of, over the years, you know, I help people start businesses. I work with mostly coaches and healers and people who have actually had realizations about their career through their work with psychedelics and sacred plant medicines. They've had these awakenings realizing, like, you know what, I don't enjoy what I'm doing anymore. It's misaligned with who I am and what my values are. Let me go do something else that can help. And it's interesting over the years how many nurses I've had as clients, doctors even, traditional therapists who not only were burnt out but didn't like the traditional model of therapy, where they thought, okay, for the amount of work I'm doing, I actually can't make that much. And then I'm paying, you know, before COVID, you know, rent in a city that's so expensive, or my office, you know, takes a certain amount of clients just to pay for my office. You know, and then also had limitations on what their work was, like how much, you know, what can I do or what, you know, can't I do, or can I bring in these kind of, you know, like somatic therapy or dance therapy or music, like the non-traditional models that weren't as accepted. So it's been interesting to watch things changing. And yes, it's all happening so fast. And I agree, you're right. Everything's moving very fast. And I know there's more and more people talking about how does psychedelics get it right? You know, like how do we not make mistakes and just rush right in? But of course, welcome to civilization 2022. You know, everybody just wants to quickly like jump on it. And I get it. You know, there is an enthusiasm, especially when you've been on this path. You know, you realize like, wow, this has helped me so much. I want to be able to help others. And this is where, you know, I'm a fan of like when I work with clients who say, I want to bring in psychedelics into my coaching or my healing practice. It's like, okay, well, how do you do this in the least harmful way, right? Like maybe it's a microdose. Maybe it's like once every, you know, 9 months. It doesn't have to be this thing. And I personally don't work with facilitators, people that just want to, you know, like, oh, I just want to start serving mushrooms to everyone, because there is that. And I was actually going to ask you about that as well. Like, have you seen, for some reason, I've noticed this huge increase over the last 2 or 3 years of people, you know, and I get it. Like, I know there's this, there's the ego, right? And then there's like enthusiasm. And people just say, I want everyone to experience this. I could hold space for people. I can give mushrooms to a circle or one-on-one. Have you seen this in your communities, more and more people feeling called to serve medicine or lead retreats or take people to, you know, like do circles or the healing work? I mean, have you seen an increase, or is this just kind of people that are coming to me where I, you know, and I project my own personal views onto them. Like, okay, there's a limit. And then there's like, you know, there's a way to do it, but then there's limitations, I believe.
Oh yeah. I definitely encounter that a lot. You know, I think that sometimes I wonder, like, maybe the high hasn't worn off yet, and that's why you're so you know, I've like when I first started doing mushrooms, I kind of felt that way too. I'm like, oh yeah, and I learned very quickly that like a lot of us are not equipped to hold space but a lot of us don't have the proper container to hold space in a way that is safe and fruitful for everyone involved. So, yeah, I myself used to think that way, but I learned quickly that, like, everyone reacts to these substances differently. And I was just telling my friend who's a therapist yesterday, we were having the same conversation. I was like, you know, there's a lot of people who think, oh, everyone in the world just took psychedelics, the world will be a better place. And I'm like, man, I wish it was that simple, because I would go pour some acid in all our water supplies. Like, it's not that simple, you know? number one, it's not safe for everyone. Everyone can't take psychedelics. Everyone's not meant to take psychedelics. And that's okay. Like, these are powerful substances. And I think a lot of people, like those people you're talking about who are like super enthusiastic, they kind of oversell it, right? And kind of undersell, like, you know, the more challenging parts of a psychedelic journey, right? So for me, when I was in college, when I first did mushrooms, I vomited. And within the first, like, 20 minutes, I felt like I was drunk almost, and I didn't have control of my body. And it's kind of disorienting, right? But for a lot of people, that could be really scary and challenging. And so we have to be honest about the psychedelic experience. I hear some people kind of describe it as fun. And to me, it's like, okay, like, it's fun in the sense that, like, healing is good for you and makes you a better person, but it's not actually fun. It's not actually, like, my idea of, like, ooh, fun, you know? Maybe acid, but, you know, mushrooms, definitely not. mushrooms, I laugh a lot when I'm on mushrooms, but for me, mushrooms is, like, deep introspection, reflection, that kind of thing. So I always tell people, if you're not ready to look in the mirror and see everything, don't do mushrooms, right? If you're not really ready to face yourself and everything about you, your deepest, darkest secrets, don't do mushrooms. Like, it's, and that's okay. Some people aren't ready. And that's okay. Like they will come when they're called to do it. And in terms of like frequency, I find a lot of people who, you know, they're talking crap about heroin users or meth users being addicted and all this stuff. I'm like, you're using mushrooms every day. Like, not to judge, but, you know, are you really integrating the knowledge that you're getting from all these experiences? Or are you just using them to avoid your issues, right? So I think we have to be honest about that too, because there's this assumption that like, oh, if you use psychedelics, you're automatically more enlightened, you know, you're more zen. And I think for some people, it can be used to enable dysfunction. And not to stigmatize people, not to judge people, but that's just how pain and trauma work. Sometimes we have coping mechanisms that don't always work for us. They might have worked for us in one part of our life, but they don't work for us anymore. So I always kind of approach it with an attitude that of like, I only use psychedelics when I feel like I need them. I don't really do them for fun. I do them when I feel like I really need them. And that's what I try to tell other people is like, these are plants, these are fungi, these are beings on their own, and you have to have respect for them. And that means not overusing them, right? And that's with anything, any substance, any resource, right? We don't want to be wasteful and just, you know, use them all willy-nilly. And I've started to have that approach with substances like alcohol too. Like knowing what's my limit and knowing that alcohol is also a powerful substance and, you know, I don't have to use a lot.
Yeah, and it just becomes another thing, right? And mm-hmm. It's been interesting to watch, you know, the enthusiasm. And I'm one of them. Here I am with the Psychedelic Entrepreneur podcast. It's been a huge part of my life. And mm-hmm. I'm constantly saying, like, the real healing and the real work and the real benefit of these medicines are through the integration, through the support, through attending communities or circles or whatever it is. It's not through using, because then you have to question, like, okay, is there actually something you're avoiding, like you just mentioned, coping mechanisms. I've personally been with people where, you know, I've said, and actually my ex-partner even wrote a whole article about how psychedelics are not good for certain people with certain traumas and certain mm-hmm. patterning in their being, right? Like their mm-hmm. energetic patterning. And it can actually make them worse, which I think is the next level of what needs to be talked about in the mainstream, is that these are not actually the cure-all for everybody, you know? Mm-hmm. And it's not, you know, and then we can talk about dosage. And then the mm-hmm. real mm-hmm. conversation, which I talk about a lot, is the integration. It's like, okay, mm-hmm. well, you know, are these even really helping you? Or are they mm-hmm. re-traumatizing you? Or are they, do you have the proper support to then process what came through? And that's another realm of accessibility is, and there's more and more people. I have clients myself that are called towards psychedelic integration, where they've gone and studied, mm-hmm. you know, somatic therapy or mm-hmm. trauma-informed therapies and breath work mm-hmm. and all these other modalities to then help people really understand that it's not just about doing psychedelics, you know, every week and hoping that one day you're fixed and enlightened. Because mm-hmm. mm-hmm. I've seen it. I actually had a client a few years ago where I've never thought this day would come, but it was like 3 or 4 years ago. I told her, I was like, you have to stop doing mushrooms. She was taking them almost weekly. And then every time we would talk, she'd have this whole entire, you know, other epiphany. And after a while, I was like, you know, you have to be discerning about what comes through these medicines. They're not, you know, some of these are actually not real answers. They're like ego inflation, right? And and it's just a fascinating world that we're in to watch. But, you know, one last question, because, you know, we have to go soon. But I'm curious what you think of integration. And then also, you know, mm-hmm. what is on your radar for the work that you're doing from now forward? Like, what's coming up for you and your collective in 2022? Are you personally, like, What's your next big project or initiative?
Integration, I think, looks, it can look different for everyone, right? I think for me, when I first started doing mushrooms, I kind of just write down my thoughts kind of freeform the next day, right? And I think I also, like I said, I've been in therapy for a while, and so sometimes I use therapy for integration, unpacking what I experienced or what came up on my trip. And I often find that those therapy sessions are really, like, really full and juicy because there's just so much, you know? So I think of these, you know, mushrooms, other psychedelics as a tool of healing, right? Like you said, there's somatic therapy. I actually just took a somatic sex education course. And yeah, that's another tool, right? Getting people in touch with their bodies and comfortable sexually. All of these are different tools in our toolbox, right? And it's up to you what tool you want to use, but don't use the tool just for the sake of using it, right? Use it to actually meet your goal or get to where you need to be. So I think, you know, integration circles are great. Therapy is great. You know, talking to a friend or a coach is great. And I think it's really about, you know, taking those gems that you got from your trip, your downloads, whatever you call them, and implementing them slowly, right? It's not going to happen overnight. Change does not happen overnight. And we have to be patient with ourselves. We also have to be compassionate towards ourselves. And I think something that comes up a lot in trips are things from our past. And sometimes that can trigger us or make us angry or make us sad for, like, the things we experienced in the past. And I think part of integration is accepting it, right? Just kind of, you know, giving yourself a big hug and being like, this, you know, this thing happened, or I went through this, and that's just it. You know, I'm not a bad person, or I'm not good, or whatever. This is just acceptance, accepting where you are in life and having that awareness to know, okay, this is where I want to go, and this is how I want to do it. And of course, having a community is important. Having community, having a support system to help you and lift you up and, you know, help you implement these things, because, right, you can be aware of something, but actually implementing it is two totally different things. So yeah, that's why I think it's important to slow down, right? Take your time. And not, you know, like you were talking about your client who's doing mushrooms every week. You have to take time to implement these things, to integrate them. And then once you do that, okay, maybe you're ready for another mushroom trip. But but these things take time and practice. And, you know, so in terms of new initiatives, new projects, like I said at the beginning, we're going to be having the online conversation on mezcal, cannabis, and mushrooms next month with Fabiola Santiago. We haven't set a date yet, but we're getting there. Just be on the lookout for more information. And then we're also going to be doing another event in April around drugs and art. So, yeah, be on the lookout for that. It's going to be maybe in person in New York, COVID permitting. And
in person.
Yes, hopefully. I hope by then things are better. And you know, we're also going to be giving some of our grant money back to the community. You know, we want to support artists and writers who are working on psychedelics. So that'll probably be later in the year. And hoping to have a conference this year as well. Again, don't know if it's going to be in person or not. Fingers crossed. So we'll see. We'll keep everyone posted. But folks can stay tuned and sign up for our email list, www.pocpc.org.
Yeah, and we'll put the links right here in the show notes, including whenever it's ready, the link to your event, because that sounds really great. I want to go. And yes, please, hopefully in person, if not online conference, but we need to gather eventually, hopefully one day. Mm-hmm. And Tayo, thank you so much for being here and going over all this and sharing your voice and your truth. This is so important. I love the work you're doing. And please let us know if there's anything coming up. You know, when you have the links, we'll share it with the community and try to get the word out. And I love it, especially, you know, bringing art into the mix as well. So, I'm in the New York area. I know a lot of people in the New York area. So please, if it's in person, let me know and we'll get it out to more people.
Yes. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It was such an honor to have you here. And we'll have another interview next week on The Psychedelic Entrepreneur on Tuesdays. We'll see you then. I hope you enjoyed the episode. If you're feeling inspired, I'd appreciate it if you showed your love with a review. And check out my YouTube channel where you can find the video version of this podcast. You can also head to BethAWeinstein.com to learn more about me and grab my free business growth trainings. Remember, you carry your own unique medicine, and your medicine is what we need for these times.